Yo, P, thank you so much for the program. I've been following you up on radio.
Nice one. And we're out of here.
All right. Yeah. Laters.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can have you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082. Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends.
In 1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's well. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. "We come in peace," they said, "to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are. Sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. Ye poor, take courage, ye rich, take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people.
That's another episode, another Friday. This is Enoch from African Voices Platform. With me tonight, I have a special guest, and that's Fidel. I'll ask our guest to introduce himself.
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Fidel Budi. I'm a Liberian living in Sheffield.
Good to have you. Good to have you, Fidel. Well, as we always know, tonight we have a special program. And that special program is none other than the topic regarding a former leader of Liberia who's passed away, Prince Johnson. It's just a call conversation, really, to see who was Prince Johnson. We've heard him, you know, growing up and reading papers with all the historical facts about Prince Johnson. You as a Liberian, what would you say? I mean, who is this man? Who is Prince Johnson?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me. So Prince Johnson was, so he died on Thursday morning. He was a Liberian. He was a former soldier turned rebel leader and turned politician and became senator of one of the biggest counties in Liberia. So he was born. So he died at age 72. So he was quite young when he joined the army in the 70s. At the time, a lot of young indigenous Liberians saw the army as one way of trying to get access to power. Because at the time, unfortunately for the country, it had been led for over 130 years by the Americo-Liberian elites. So he joined the army, served in Liberia. He trained in America as well, and then returned to Liberia. And in 1980, there was a coup d'etat in Liberia, the first of its kind in our country. He was not one of the officers who orchestrated the coup, but he was close to one of them. So there was the late General Thomas Kuonkwa. So they were from the same county, Nimba County in Liberia. And so he served as Kuonkwa's aide-de-camp, you know, so his personal aide. Unfortunately, President Doe, who was the head of the army that took over in 1980, and Kuonkwa fell apart around 1983. So Kuonkwa and Prince Johnson had to flee Liberia to neighboring countries. And whilst there, they orchestrated a coup d'etat in 1985 that was unsuccessful. And because they were from the Nimba County area, President Doe, in retaliation, took his frustration out on the people of Nimba County. So when these two sons of Nimba came in to try and overthrow him and failed, there were quite a few Nimbaians who were killed in the aftermath. And that kind of created this animosity between the tribal group that President Doe belonged to and the group that Prince Johnson belonged to. General Kuonkwa was killed, and then Prince Johnson aligned himself with Charles Taylor, who I'm sure most of your listeners and yourself have heard about, to launch a civil war in 1989 against President Doe. Unfortunately, Johnson's ideology was that the arms or the gun that liberates shouldn't lead, whereas President Taylor or rebel leader Taylor at the time wanted to become president. And that's how him and Prince Johnson fell apart. So President Taylor had his own armed forces, and Prince Johnson had his own rebel group as well. He was the guy who killed President Doe. So he captured President Doe and brutally murdered him in 1990. August 1990, when he killed President Doe. And then around 92, he fled Liberia to Nigeria, where he was seeking asylum, until 2004, when he returned to Liberia, stood in an election in 2005 to be senator in Nimba County. He tried a couple of times to be president, 2011, and I think 2017, he ran, came third and fourth, respectively, but continued to serve in the Senate. And he was still senator of Nimba County when he died on Thursday morning.
Wow. What? I wouldn't want to call it a colourful background, but Prince Johnson was a controversial figure, you know, during the Liberian Civil War, and later became the interim president at some point. I mean, can you give us like a brief overview of his rise to prominence? I know you've mentioned some of the bits around his political stance within the Liberian politics, but if you ask any ordinary Liberian, would they agree or disagree who Prince Johnson was in terms of his leadership, in terms of the positive things that he did or the achievements for the Liberians?
Well, I think if you try to dissect his contribution to Liberia, there will be people who would see his contributions as noble, but then there will be people, a lot of people, who would see his contributions to Liberia as not so noble. So if we start with those who would see him as noble, these would be mostly people who are from Nimba County.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I mentioned earlier, President Doe made it tribal when Kwankpa and Johnson tried to overthrow him in 1985, and he took it out on the people of Nimba County. There were a lot of killings in Nimba County in retaliation to the coup d'etat. And most people in Nimba County see or saw Senator Johnson as their liberator. So for the people of Nimba County, whenever Prince Johnson said, "This is the direction I want us to go in," most people in Nimba County followed his instructions and the direction they wanted to go in. So with him around, the people of Nimba County felt safe. They felt that they had someone who could protect them in terms of making sure that what they experienced under President Dole will not happen again in their time. Now, in terms of those, and this is the majority of Liberians who do not see him as so noble, there are a lot of reasons. He never became president, so he was never president of Liberia. Okay. The highest he went was senator.
Right.
But he, you know, people who knew or who were in the areas that Prince Johnson controlled will tell you that he was very strict. That basically stories that we've heard was that when his soldier guys or his rebel group looted from people or took things away that weren't theirs, he would execute them because he believed that they were there to liberate the people and they couldn't terrorize the people whilst they were doing that. However, there are a couple of Liberian musicians, like very popular musicians from the 80s that he killed for reasons nobody can explain, apart from the fact that, you know, a lot of people, the stories I've heard personally from family members who lived within his area, is 1 minute he can be having a conversation with you, and the next minute he was just going to shoot you, and that's it. And then 2 minutes later, you ask, "Oh, but where's Fidel? I was just talking to him now." And like, "But Chief, you just shot the guy." And you're like, "Ah, okay." And just, you know. So there was a lot of, there were a lot of stories about how he acted as though he was under the control of something else when he was a rebel leader. But there was also this aspect of him that was very strict in terms of making sure that his soldiers did not take away from people, did not treat civilians badly, and did not, you know, like some of the things that people accuse Charles Taylor and his group of doing, like looting and plundering and taking things away. These things did not happen, even though the fear of living under his control was still there. But he was more strict on his soldiers to make sure that they acted within the confines of the military code, as he would put it.
Would you say then he paved the way for Charles Taylor to be the way he turned out to be? Because anyone that's heard of Charles Taylor, you know, his leadership was absolutely brutal. You know, there was so much that went on during Charles Taylor's leadership. The way you've just described some of those elements about Prince Johnson kind of like mirrors exactly what Charles Taylor did. Although there must have been some achievements, you know, in his leadership, but he left a big, massive mark. You know, I mean, I was young when I heard of the execution of President Doe.
Well, I would differ. I think there was a significant difference between the two men. I'm talking about Charles Taylor and Prince Johnson. I think President Taylor, when he was a rebel leader, his focus, because I lived in areas that he controlled during the war, and he had a structure in place. He had a functioning government in place, right? So you had the, I think it was the NPRAG, government, National Patriotic Reconciliation Government, or something like that. So Taylor was intended on governance, right? From the start, he wanted to govern Liberia. He wanted to be president of Liberia. Prince Johnson, on the other hand, was never interested in governing Liberia. Prince Johnson, throughout the war, was always interested in one thing and one thing only: revenge. Right? Prince Johnson, having seen his good friend, Thomas Kwankpa, killed in 1985 by Dole, having seen many of his countrymen in Nimba County, you know, killed by the regime of President Dole in retaliation, his pure instincts, and the only reason he came to fight a war was not because he wanted to get rich, like President Taylor tried to do. Not because he wanted to be president, like President Taylor tried to do and became. Prince Johnson cared about killing Samuel Doe. That's all he cared about. Which is why, when the opportunity presented itself, he took it. And it was brutal. You know, I've seen the video, and the world has seen the video in terms of how brutally he slaughtered President Doe. But that was his intention. So he didn't, you know, like, people who, because I was in a part of Liberia where I was born, called Bong Mines, just when the war had started, and Charles Taylor and his group had come in. So they took over the town, and Prince Johnson and his group attacked the town whilst Charles Taylor and his group were there, and they ran him out. And what I heard, because we couldn't go out because there was shootings and like for 2 days straight, is that all Prince Johnson did was just kill all of the Taylor guys that he met there. Didn't take any stuff. Didn't try to loot anything. Just took his guys when he was ready to move on and just moved out of the town. And Charles Taylor and his men came back in. So he never tried to capture any territory. It wasn't about territories for him. Mm. It was never about wealth for him. Once Samuel Doe, President Doe, was killed, for him, that was his thing, you know, his achievement, right? He wanted out. And in 1992, I think less than a year or about a year after he killed President Doe, he fled to Nigeria to seek asylum. Because, again, his army was very small compared to the other factions that were there in Liberia. So it's clear in terms of my own analysis of the situation that he was not bothered about. And I know we'll talk about this later in terms of his campaigns to be president and whom he supported, but he himself, I don't think, ever really wanted to be president of Liberia. He just wanted to kill Samuel Doe, and he got his
You reckon he was hell-bent on revenge, you know, just to come and take out Samuel Doe?
That's exactly what it was. Because if you look at the way the Civil War unfolded, Taylor was the first guy that came in with Prince Johnson. They split quite early on. So within the first 2 months of coming in, this is according to Prince Johnson's own testimony at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Liberia. So they split early on. Johnson went his way, Taylor went his way, because they had differences of ideology. And then you had other splinter groups that came up to fight against Taylor. And all of these groups had something similar to the Charles Taylor group that the Prince Johnson group didn't have. And basically what they all were interested in was wealth creation and territory. Everybody wanted a territory to control and wanted to get as much of the Liberian natural resources sold, pocket the money. And they all lived within these areas as kings, right? Whereas Prince Johnson, again, those who were with him have said that he lived like a soldier, always. He never tried to live like a president or control territories or try and impose himself on a group of people. He just lived. And again, like I said, in answering the question, he wanted to kill Samuel Doe, right? That was his number one mission. And he expected that him and Taylor were going to come in, get rid of Doe, and then allow a democratic process to take place. But then soon as he realized, I know Taylor doesn't want that, Taylor wants to be president, he then decided, no, I'm here to kill Doe. And I'm just going to go my way, get my guy, and then get out.
Do you reckon then, earlier on in the program, you mentioned about, you know, the tribal factions. Do you reckon this animosity between Prince Johnson and Samuel Doe was based on the tribal differences, or was he sort of like personal hatred?
Well, it's a bit of both. I think the personal hatred was there because of what he felt President Doe had done to the people of Nimba County. He felt that President Doe wronged the people of Nimba County. Because this is what happened. So in 1980, when President Doe, and there were 17 guys, he was one of the 17 guys. Kuangba was part of them, and there were other guys as well. So it was a very colorful group of individuals. It wasn't one tribal group. It was almost every tribal group was represented in the 17. And once they, because I've read a couple of books on this and I've spoken to some people about it, once they took over, Kwangba insisted that Samodo will be the head because he was the highest ranking officer at the time. A couple of the other guys, there's a guy called Thomas Wessan and then another guy called Nicholas Podia, who were both interested in becoming the head. But again, Thomas Kwangba pushed back on these guys. So when President Doe became president and head of the PRC, he started to surround himself with his own tribal men. And that meant that they started to advise him on what they felt was the best for him, which was to stay in power, not to hand over to a civilian government. And in that process, him and Kwangba, because Kwangba and Prince Johnson had similar ideologies that, look, if we're going to liberate the people, and you have to understand, and I was researching today, and I was thinking about, I think it was President, the late Jerry Rawlings. Mm. So Jerry Rawlings took over, I think, in the late 70s and handed over to a civilian government, right? And I think most of the coup d'etats happening at the time, even in Nigeria, we saw something similar where someone would overthrow and then hand over to a civilian government. So I think most of the military at the time was like, okay, yeah, we'll get rid of the corrupt guys and then hand it over back to the people who are the politicians and know. And once Doe decided that he wasn't going to do that, him and Kwangba fell apart. He had already, President Doe had killed some of his, the 17 men, because again, you know, when it comes to military power, people are always concerned about the other person. Everyone's concerned that the next guy wants to take their power. And yeah, so President Doe had killed a few people who had come with them. So the 17 had diminished significantly. Many of them fled. Many of them were killed. Including Kwangba running away, coming back. So yeah, for I think for Prince Johnson, it was revenge.
Mm.
It was a hatred brought on by what he felt was the unfair treatment of the people of Nimba County. Because in 1983, when President Doe first accused Kwangba of trying to get rid of him, he tried to kill him. He ran away with Prince Johnson. There was something in Liberia called the Nimba Raid of 1983, where President Doe sent soldiers into Nimba County under the pretense of trying to find Kwangba and killed a lot of people. There's stories about how these people were put in mass graves. And it was basically to quell any idea of a coup. Like, even though Kwangba was gone, he wanted to send a message that, look, if your county, anyone from this county comes after me, this is what I'm going to do. So I think, yeah, I think for Prince Johnson, there was a hatred. There was a strong hatred. And because of his closeness with General Kwangba, I think the fact that President Doe killed him in 1985 after the coup failed, that left another... So it's almost like you've got two brothers who've been close to each other and one of them get killed and the other one say, okay, I'm going to try and revenge this killing. And yeah, I think there is no doubt in my mind that Prince Johnson wanted to kill President Doe out of revenge and hatred as well.
Oh, yeah. I think for our listeners, you know, I've read about Liberian history, but only up to a certain stage. When you go back, I think this is a reflection of what, you know, some of the African politics is raised. We've seen tribal wars and conflicts spanning on for decades.
Mm.
Up until today, there's some countries that are hell-bent on tribal conflicts. But in Liberia, I think the history is so rich in that some people, basically, when they hear these stories of these presidents, come, kill people, go on, someone else comes, does the same thing. There is the element of people that are unaware of the history of Liberia. Can you give us a bit of a context in terms of the historical background? I mean, we know the Americo-Liberians and the local indigenous tribes. What was the relationship in between, you know, obviously building up, you know, freed enslaved Africans coming back to Liberia or to Africa in general, because there was some in Sierra Leone, so there's kind of like a bit of a distinction in Liberia and Sierra Leone as well. But in Liberia now in particular, do you think this whole historical perspective of the tribes, I wouldn't really want to call them tribes because they're not tribes.
Mm.
You know, it's just you come in today as a visitor, you found me in my home, we lived together peacefully for years and decades to come. And then all of a sudden, you see me as inferior, or I'll see you as superior, you know, the other way around. And all of a sudden, there's a conflict. So give us a perspective to our listeners so they can understand what is this tribal, you know, what are these differences, you know, amongst Liberians?
Yeah, so the thank you. The history of Liberia is quite unique when it comes to the rest of the continent. Mm. So first of all, in 1820, so you have to give a better understanding, you have to go all the way back. Mm-hmm. So you had a situation in the U.S. in the early 1820s where you had a lot of free black people, right? So a lot of slaves had become free and they were just roaming around the U.S. A lot of slavers at the time were worried that if their slaves continue to see freed black men walking around, it would entice them to rebel. So they needed to find a solution to reduce the number of free black men in the United States. So they came up with this idea of repatriating them. Initially, it was to the Caribbean. But a lot of them felt, nah, that's too close to the U.S. And when things turn around, you just come there and grab us again, yeah. Right? So we want to go further afield. So there was a mission sent to Sierra Leone, Shebro Island, in the early 1820s to go and assess, like, you know, go and see if there is somewhere on the dark continent that we can ship these guys back to. So the American Colonization Society, the ACS, was founded. And its mission was to unofficially lobby the U.S. government to provide, because the Americans never wanted a colony, because at the time they had just gained independence from the UK. Mm. They too were a colony. They didn't want to practice what they fought against. So they decided, okay, look, if you guys are going to do it, you have to do it self-governed. So they went to Sierra Leone, had a lot of issues with mosquitoes and malaria. Mm. A lot of them died. And so they decided to kind of go further down along the coast to see if there was somewhere more conducive that they could live. And they came to Providence Island in on the coast of Monrovia. And it was there that the U.S. Captain Robert Stockton aided the American-Liberians to negotiate. And I use negotiate very loosely, because depending on what narrative you read, there are accounts that he basically held a gun to one of the chief's head to say, look, you have to sell the land. And for myself, as an expert in land rights and land grabbing, we refer to that as the first land grab in Liberia. That was the first official land grab. Mm. So the Americans kind of facilitated that first land grab. So anyway, the American-Liberians settled in Monrovia. And then more and more started to come. So as news got back that, look, there's this colony on the west coast of Africa where we are self-governing. So you had a black governor in Joseph Jenkins Roberts, and people from the Caribbean and from Southern America started to move to Liberia. However, the idea when the American-Liberians came in, again, depending on which narrative you go with, was never to integrate with the indigenous Liberians. Right. They felt of themselves as better. They saw indigenous Liberians as primitive, backward, or country boys, as they would refer to them. And this meant that from 1822, when the colony was founded, up until 1980, Liberia had pure American-Liberian rule. So 1822 to 1847, we had colonies, so you had governors. And then in 1847, Liberia was declared an independent state in response to British incursions from Sierra Leone into Liberia. So they were taking land. And every time Liberia complained, it's like, well, but you're not a country, so how can you don't have the right to complain. So these guys decided, look, let's set up a country. So again, indigenous Liberians were never welcomed into the decision-making process. They weren't part of this idea to set up a country. These were chiefdoms, right? Just, you know, chiefdoms spread across, just living, enjoying themselves, living on the land. And here you've got these guys that have come in, don't want to integrate with us, and now they're setting up a state that is including us that we didn't contribute to setting up. And for years, the government in Monrovia only prioritized their own interests. Mm-hmm. So basically all of the wealth of this country was being generated to facilitate the good life of the American-Liberian elites in Monrovia. And when things like rubber became important in the early 1900s due to the world wars that were going on, the U.S. needed to produce tires and stuff like that, Liberia became a strategic partner to the U.S., so that even gave the American-Liberians more power, because they're the ones negotiating, they're getting the wealth, they're building the big farms, and they're just enriching themselves to the detriment. Now, the issue that really broke the camel's back was, we had President Tubman, who was an American-Liberian, had led the country for 27 years from 1944 until 1971, when he died in a clinic here in London. And his vice president, William Talbot, was sworn in. Now, he promised to expand the country in terms of the leadership and in terms of access to power to include indigenous Liberians. But then the development was going too slow. You know, this opening up of the powers to bring the country boys in was going too slow. So the country boys, a few of them had had opportunities to travel overseas to get education. Some of them had seen what was going on in other countries and in the sub-region as well. You know, like all of these African countries were all, you know, you had all these revolutionaries that were taking over. It was becoming more of like, if you don't like it, you have to stand up and fight. Exactly. So they started to agitate. And President Talbot didn't know how to manage the situation. Unfortunately for him, his army was full of indigenous Liberians, because the American Liberians were too rich and too powerful to go and be army officers, right?
They want to get it.
Exactly. So they brought these country boys in to protect them. And unfortunately, the same people who you protect are protecting you are the people that you're suppressing.
Mm.
And that's how this agitation finally got to a boiling point on April 12, 1980. And that's how Samuel Doe and his guys decided, like, no, this is it. This is enough now. And not only were they oppressing the country in general, but even the army. You know, there were stories that ministers of government will go to the barracks and take 10, 15 soldiers and take them to their farm to go and clear the land, cut the grass, clean their house, wash their cars, and pretty much just disrespect the army. And these guys was like, we're like, well, we're supposed to be officers, right? You're supposed to treat us with respect, and you're basically treating us as like we're slaves. And those were all of the various things that kind of led to, there was a rice riot.
Animosity.
There was a rice riot in 1979 that really troubled the Talbot government. He cracked down, took a lot of the educated progressives, as they referred to them at the time, young Liberians who were pushing for change. He had him in jail. And the story was, he was about to travel out of Liberia, and whilst he was away, these guys were going to be killed. And that is the thing that necessitated the coup to happen as it did. So he was basically in the mansion the night before he was supposed to travel. And because they knew that once he left this country, all of those guys in prison are going to get killed, the army officers who were guiding the president decided, like, no, we can't let this happen. So this is the only opportunity that we have. And that's how. So the coup was basically a kind of retaliation to 130-something years of American-Liberian dominance of the country. Now, I travel back home quite often. And if you go through Liberia now, especially in Monrovia, a lot of the major developments, right, properties, buildings, and things like those, are owned by American-Liberian descendants. So all of that wealth that they created over years of plundering the country is still, so even though we've had the coup d'etat,
the signs are still there.
It's still there. You know, the wealth is still in their hands. It's like if you look at the United States of America, for example, the richest people there are all descendants of slave owners, right?
Yeah.
So they use this free labor to amass all this wealth, and it's generational. So it goes down from one generation to one
Same as here as well.
Exactly.
You know, and same as in England as well. Yeah.
And that, even now, you know, is still an issue for the country. But that's just a historical context. You know, it was a brief kind of run through, but just to tell you, yeah.
Honestly, that's amazing, because many people would have had, you know, some snippets of that history, without understanding the whole big picture. You know, I mean, I didn't know much of what you just described, but the fact that it gives context to all these conflicts that's happened in Liberia, and then come Prince Johnson now, you know, he's passed. Many Liberians, or the indigenous, or the country boys, as you refer them to, will kind of like reflect back and think, this man was brutal. You know, this man was the baddest man in Liberian politics. Some might rejoice of his death. Some might be sad about it. But looking back, I don't think humanity, we are human beings. You can never, however bad your enemy is, you know, when they go, they've gone. So there's kind of like that bit of respect, you know, we give to the deceased. But looking at this stark beginning of Prince Johnson, I mean, in a way, if you look around the era of the 80s and late 70s, there were some revolutions going on around the African continent. There was so much coups and wars and conflicts. Maybe if you push it back to the 60s, wars of independence, you know, most African countries gained independence in the 60s. So a lot of them were sort of like mirroring with each other, you know. If you look at some of the country, I mean, Sierra Leone had its unfair share, you know. I think it mirrored quite a lot of Liberia, I think in the neighbours. And most of the historical context that's being left behind by what some of these people refer to as the strong men, you know, strong men of Africa. So that title, I have a problem with that title, because it's not about being a strong man. It's about looking out for the interests of your people. But more so now going on, there's Sir Alif Johnson, George Weah. So all these presidents have come and go in a democratic process. Do you think this gives Liberians a bit more hope, you know, more kind of like some positive outlook on the political landscape of Liberia?
Well, it depends. You know, I think one of the things I would like to touch on the Prince Johnson situation, because today I, well, yesterday and today I did some reflection, because when he passed, so there aren't many people in Liberia who weren't touched personally by Prince Johnson. So I've got an uncle that he killed. There are other people who have family members that he killed. I've got friends of mine who are related to him, and I actually dated a lady who's his niece, right? So the same guy who killed my uncle, you know, I ended up dating his niece, and I've got friends who are related to him. So yeah, so that's how interconnected the country is. But I think when I look at his death, and I was reflecting on it, you want to try and see influence. You want to see, okay, yes, we know that he killed President Doe. And for a lot of people outside of Liberia, that's where their focus will be. Oh, he's a rebel leader. This is what he's done. He's killed President Doe and blah, blah, blah. And that's a fact you can't get away from. But one of the things that I posted today was that, look, Liberia has lost its most significant selector of presidents. Right? That's how I put it. It's most significant selector of presidents. And the reason I put it that way is because when I look at President Taylor, and then we had an interim president called Sawyer before Charles Taylor. And then we had Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And then we had George Weah. And now we have Joseph Boakai. All of these guys were either removed or got in place because of actions of Prince Johnson. And I'll explain. So President Doe was removed from the presidency because Prince Johnson killed him, right? So when Prince Johnson killed him, that's it. He took out that president. And there was a vacuum created. It was a void because we didn't have a president. And his killing of President Doe meant that Emma Sawyer was able to become interim president of Liberia in the early 90s, up until, I think, 1994, when he left office. And indirectly, by killing President Doe, the route for Charles Taylor was created, because Taylor cannot become president if Doe is still alive. If President Doe is still, if Prince Johnson doesn't kill President Doe, Charles Taylor does not become president. He can fight for as long as he wants, but he doesn't become president. Now, in 2011, I was in Liberia, and witnessed the elections in Liberia. And it was President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf going up against a guy called Winston Tubman. It's the nephew of the late President William V.S. Tubman. And he had George Weah as his vice presidential candidate. And that was a strong ticket. I believe that for most Liberians, the argument is that George Weah won the election in 2005 because he won the first round. But there were some deals done, and that's how Ellen became president. Now, I don't know. I wasn't there, so I can't speculate on that. And I stayed far away from it in my comments that I made today. But 2011, I was there. And I felt very strongly that the support of Prince Johnson, because Nimba County is the second largest in terms of votes in Liberia. Whomever wins Nimba County wins the presidency, right? So whether it be Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in 2011, George Weah in 2017, or Joseph Boakai in 2023, if you win Nimba County, you win the presidency. And to win Nimba County, Prince Johnson has to endorse you. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf does not win in 2011 if Prince Johnson did not endorse her. It's clear. The numbers show. The number of Nimbians who voted for Prince Johnson in the election in the first round mirrored the number of Nimbians who voted for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in the second round, which clearly indicates to me, and which is why I made the statement as a selector in chief, is that when he tells his followers, this is where we're going, that's where his followers will go. The same thing, I did some calculations back in 2020, looking at the numbers from 2017, looking at the numbers from the first round for Prince Johnson and George Weah, and looking at the numbers in the second round that George Weah amassed, and it's a mirror, right? George Weah got 8,000 more votes in the second round. That was more than what him and Prince Johnson got. So, for example, if Prince Johnson had 200,000 votes in the first round and George Weah had 400,000, in the second round, George Weah has 608,000. Right, so the only 8,000 Liberians that hadn't voted for George Weah or Prince Johnson in the first round switched. Right, so it mirrored. You know, it did happen in 2011, and if you look at 2023, our current vice president is from Nimba County. He was a protege of Prince Johnson. Not only was he part of his party, but basically the reason he won his Senate seat in Nimba County before becoming vice president was because of Prince Johnson. Prince Johnson basically, once he lifted his hand up like this and said, look, this is the candidate that I want, that was it. He won the election and won it handsomely. So now Prince Johnson, I believe, was a very clever guy. Whilst he ran for president twice in 2011 and 2017, he understood that the Liberian people were not ready to go that far. Yeah, the people in Nimba County trust him, but the rest of the country were not ready to go that far. So he realized that in 2023, and he asked for his prodigy. Right, so I've got a copy of a tape that one of the newspaper, a very good journalist in a newspaper in Liberia, published of Prince Johnson on the telephone with someone saying to them, look, I want you guys to support Joseph Boakai. Don't worry, he's old. Kun, who is the vice president, very young guy, so Kun will be the one doing all the work, right? So just vote for him. Don't worry about this. It's Kun that will be. So basically, he knew exactly what he was doing. He put his man, second in command, as his way of saying, okay, look, if you put my guy on the ticket, so I'll vote for you. So he has had that influence. So Ellen Johnson wouldn't have been president if it wasn't for Prince Johnson in 2011. George Weah would have never won the presidency in 2017, because if Prince Johnson had endorsed Boakai, that was it for Weah. And again in 2023, as soon as he fell out with George Weah, everybody knew what was going to happen. And that's exactly what happened in the end. Even though George Weah did put up a good fight. But, you know, Prince Johnson effect, you know, and it will be for myself as a political observer of Liberian politics. It will be interesting to see, okay, who's going to be the next kingsmaker, right? Because this guy, it's clear, was the kingsmaker in chief of Liberia. So who's going to be the next kingsmaker in Liberia?
Where's this influence coming from?
Again, like I mentioned earlier, it started with the issue of Samuel Doe. It started with the Nimba people feeling that they needed someone to protect them from Samuel Doe. Prince Johnson was that guy, and he was always referred to as the godfather of Nimba County. Right? He was always referred to as the godfather of Nimba County, because whenever he went to Nimba, he told the people, look, you know, I'm the only person who fought for you right? Mm. So it was emotional blackmail in a way.
He's playing that card, yeah.
But he understood that, look. And one of the things you can say, because I grew up a part of my life in Nimba County. I've got a lot of friends from Nimba County. I consider it as an adopted home of mine. The people from Nimba County are very, can be, not are, they can be very united. When there is an issue that threatens their existence, they are quick to reunite around that issue. And the notion that Senator Johnson would remind them that, look, you remember, it's because 1983 and 1985 are not that far away.
No.
Many of the people who are voting now, either they were alive at that time or their parents were alive at that time. And they tell them, look, the last time we messed up, this is what we suffered, right? Mm. So you have to listen to Prince Johnson. He's the only person that we trust that seeks our interest. So we need to follow. So he had his very strong hold on the county. And this is the second largest in terms of votes. Right, it competes with Monterado County closely. So if you win in Nimba County in every election that we've had since 2005, the winner of Nimba County wins the vote in Liberia. So, and he was the guy who was able to give you the votes in Nimba County. So if you get him on your side, you get the election.
So he's basically the ticket to
win. He had the keys to Nimba County.
Right. I mean, in essence, whilst he contributed, you know, to paving the way for all these presidents have been in leadership before, obviously his governance left much to be desired. What are this? I think you've described quite a few, but the notable achievements, despite all these challenges, you know. Obviously, Liberians don't want to have that reflection of the past, but the political statements have been made before by some of the presidents that have come and go. I mean, when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was a president at the time, I thought that's a huge, massive achievement for Liberia, you know. They are basically transitioning towards, you know, a democratic process than before. But there's also the fear of having these strong men in Africa. So Prince Johnson, to me, he's like one of these big boys on the block that you do what I say, or if I tell you and I give you some advice and you follow that advice, you'll get a green ticket through. So to me, it sounds as though Prince Johnson is this pivotal figure within the Liberian politics, whereby any upcoming leaders in future will kind of like be reflecting or looking into this Prince Johnson's manual of presidency and leadership in Liberia. Isn't there any fears that somewhere, somehow things could go wrong, you know, for any of the aspiring leaders to come through?
Well, I think for Nimba County, for me personally, it will be interesting because right now, when I look at the county, there isn't anyone that I can point to who will be capable of replicating what Prince Johnson has done. All right, I think what Senator Johnson's done, I can't see anyone Nimbaian now who is able to say, look, to the county, let's go in this direction, and they all follow, right? I think now that he's gone, the shackles are off.
Mm.
I think the people of the county, and it will be interesting for me personally as an observer to see how they vote in the next elections, especially this. I think we've got midterm elections in 2 years' time when we'll be electing senators.
Mm.
Obviously, there's going to be a special election to replace him because he's no longer. So it will be interesting. So personally, that is going to be my new fascination to try and see, okay, what is the absence of Prince Johnson? What effect is it having on the vote in Nimba County? I think if we want to look at legacy of Senator Johnson, I think in terms of Liberian politics, I think for me personally, it's clear, right? He basically determined who the Liberian president is or was in terms of the last three circles we had, whether it be 2011, whether it be 2017, whether it be 2023. He basically said, look, this is the president, and that person became the president because he said so. Now, he didn't do that with the barrel of the gun. He did that by what I would refer to emotionally blackmailing the people of Nimba County, reminding them of the dark days, and reminding them, I think, again, of the sacrifices that he made, right? So Prince Johnson made personal sacrifices. Prince Johnson put his life on the line. So I'll tell you a story. So he told this story himself. So when he was a rebel leader, so he was on the outskirts, where his base was, which is on the outskirts of Monrovia, the capital city. And President Doe was still alive at the time. And everybody believed that President Doe and Prince Johnson were both consulting with oracles, right? So they both were using black magics and stuff like that. But the understanding is because Nimba County and Grand Jida County are neighbors. So Doe is from Grand Jida, or was from Grand Jida, and Prince was from Nimba. They were technically brothers at some point until this falling out because of the Doe and Kwangba situation. But the understanding was that him and Samuel Doe went to the same oracle, that they were all part of that same society, right? So he understood what could kill Doe and vice versa.
Okay.
And being Prince Johnson, this is according to him, just before President Doe was captured, Prince Johnson rang President Doe, because he was in the barracks at the time in Monrovia, and said, look, I want to come and see you in the barracks. Now imagine, you started a war with Charles Taylor because you wanted to come and get rid of this guy. You've broken away from Taylor. Now you're on the outskirts. You still want to kill this guy, and you're taking the risk of going into his territory to meet him without guns or whatever. And people believe, and according to Prince, he said this in the TRC, and I encourage people to watch it on YouTube, in his TRC statement, that he knew, they both knew each other because they went to the same place. So he basically braved it to go in. And when he got in, some of the guys who were close to President Doe said to Doe, look, this guy is here now. Let's kill him, right? Because when he goes out, we don't know what's going to happen. And basically, President Doe said, no, he wasn't going to kill him, right? That all him and Prince are brothers and blah, 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 and da, 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 da. And Prince came out, went back to his base. This then gave the late President Doe a sense of confidence that, oh, okay, Prince came to my area. I can go to his area too as well. And he did not announce to Prince Johnson that, oh, I want to come and visit your area to get permission to come in. So he went into the Freeport, so the main port of Monrovia, to go and meet. By then, we had the West African peacekeepers had arrived, but they hadn't gotten onto the streets yet. They were just in Ekomok. Ekomok was just in the Freeport. That's where they were based. And again, I believe that President Doe was set up. That's my belief, but that's a personal belief of mine based on what I've read and what I've seen. So when President Doe got in, he was disarmed. His soldiers around him were disarmed to go and see the head of the Ekomok. And when whilst he was having a conversation, it leaked to Prince Johnson that President Doe was in the Freeport. And that's how he came in, stormed in, armed, and started shooting all over the place and captured President Doe from within the grasp of Ekomok, right? Within the grasp of Ekomok. And that's how he took him away. And for me, I think that was very... People would see that as brave. And I think he would point that out to the people from Nimba County. They say, look, I was willing to sacrifice my life. I went into the barracks to tempt this guy so that he would then trust me enough to come out. Because the only way he could get to Doe was to get... Because President Doe had some strong fighters. And the only way you could get to him was to get him outside of the barracks. In the barracks, you couldn't get to President Doe. And by sacrificing to go in, he was able to lure President Doe out. And that's how he was unfortunately able to capture President Doe and slaughter him as he did. And I think when he reminded... Because people, some people... from Nimba County, will be accused of not letting things go so easily. So the forgive and forget is not normally something that you would associate with some people. And I think those are the people who would look to Senator Johnson, the late Senator Johnson, and say, look, this is our guy. He kept his promise. He went in, he killed Doe in revenge for my brother who died, or my sister, or my cousin, or my whomever. And I think, yes, and he used that to his advantage. He used it to blackmail the people in Nimba County to vote in for him every time. Because every time you think he's losing his grip, he resurrects.
Comes back again.
Because sometimes someone will go in an election in Emma County and Senator Johnson will pick someone as his candidate. And it looks like this person is struggling. And he would just remind the people in Emma County, you guys know I'm the only, and before you know, bam, his candidate's won.
Blackmailing.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the complexity really makes it difficult to define his legacy. You know, I think as we reflect, all the librarians reflect on his life, what do you think people should remember Prince Johnson for in a few minutes? We're about to close.
Well, I think a lot of Liberians were yearning at the time in 1989 for something different. A lot of Liberians were yearning for a change from the Dole presidency because it was becoming brutal. So Prince Johnson, again, people will love him, people will loathe him. But Prince Johnson, I would think, part of his legacy was putting his life on the line to liberate the people of Nimba County and by extension, the Liberian people from what was every, you know, if you listen to anyone who was not part of that group of few around President Doe will say to you that the regime was becoming brutal. It was targeting people. People were going missing. There were no political dissent in Liberia. So on that front, you can say that Prince Johnson contributed to the democracy, as horrible as he was, as brutal as he killed President Doe, and as many of the people as he killed, and their family members. You know, I've seen a lot of the comments on Facebook, oh yeah, you're going to go and meet my mom, or you go and meet my uncle now. But he contributed to liberating Liberia from what the world and Liberians felt was a tyrant in the late President Doe at the time, and that ushered in the democratic process that we have today. You have a president in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf democratically handing over to a president in George Weah without any bullets flying. Mm. You have a president in George Weah democratically accepting that he had been defeated after one term in office and handing over to a president in Joseph Boakai. Mm. So I believe that his blood, his sweat, and his effort, Prince Johnson, contributed to that. As horrible as it might have been for a lot of people, because he killed a lot of innocent people as well. Mm. But he helped in his own way to bring this kind of democracy that we have now. And I think the second thing in terms of his legacy, he then selfishly started to then handpick the people that he felt were good enough to lead the country as president. Which I believe was for his personal gain because he got rich out of it.
Mm.
He built himself a university, a lot of properties. And yeah, so there's that side of it as well. So yes, he suffered and fought and struggled for our democracy, but also he profited from the democracy as well.
Oh yeah. Wise words, Fidel. I mean, legacy is a reflection of Liberia's complex journey. You know, thank you for sharing your insights today. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning into the African Voices platform. Let us remember the lessons of history, you know, and to all the African history, really, you know, the politics, the leadership's going on all across. As we navigate our present, you know, and the future, until the next time, stay safe and engaged. We're out here, African Voices platform. Take care. Thank you so much, Fidel.
Thank you.
Nothing to prove, don't you lose your hope. Don't let go, I see your soul. I feel the light in you. Feeling, shifting, breaking, lifting. Time is wasting, restless waiting. Hear me calling when you're falling. Hear me calling when you're falling. You think it's all on you. All on me. You think it's all
off your shoulders, take it off your shoulders, take it off your shoulders.
You think it's all over.